The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 1st, 2014 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Russian-made missile downs a passenger plane. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin remained defiant in the face of intense international pressure this week, after evidence overwhelmingly indicated that it was a Russian-supplied Buk missile that shot down Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine last week. All 298 people on board, including 80 children, were killed in the attack, which is believed to have been carried out by pro-Russian separatists who mistook the passenger jet for a Ukrainian military plane. The majority of the victims from the Amsterdam-Kuala Lumpur flight were Dutch. Scores of Malaysians, Australians, and British are also among the dead. Separatists initially denied investigators access to the crash site. For several days, the bodies were left to rot in the open and reportedly looted of cell phones, jewelry, and credit cards. After an international outcry, military planes finally transported most of the victims to the Netherlands for identification. Vladimir Putin and Russian officials fiercely denied responsibility and claimed that Flight 17 had probably been shot down by Ukrainian military jets. But American intelligence analysts said the downed plane's fuselage was strewn with telltale shrapnel holes and blistered paint that result from a Buk missile, which explodes just before reaching its target. Other evidence of separatist and Russian involvement includes photos of a Buk mobile launcher without at least one of its missiles, retreating into Russia shortly after the plane's destruction. President Obama called the attack an outrage of unspeakable proportions and threatened Russia with further economic sanctions if it continued to support the separatists. The EU failed to take any immediate action, deciding to wait for an investigation into the attack on Flight 17. What the editorial said: Vladimir Putin has blood on his hands, said the Seattle Times. In his determination to keep Ukraine in Russia's orbit, he inspired and armed the rebels who downed this airliner. It's obvious why the separatists blocked access to the crash site, so that it could be scrubbed of Russian fingerprints. This atrocity now brings the West to a moment of moral and strategic clarity, said the Wall Street Journal. Even when Putin annexed Crimea in March, the first land grab of a sovereign European state since World War II, the West responded only with toothless sanctions. Stopping this would-be czar will require firm, unified action from both Europe and America, including crippling sanctions. What the columnist said: this is Putin's Lockerbie, said Adrian Karatinicki in NewRepublic.com. The Libyan ordered 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 turned Muammar al-Qaddafi into international pariah, and the same could happen to Putin. The Russian president essentially has two options. Either he continues supporting the rebels and tries to weather the inevitable sanctions and international opprobrium, or he abandons them, losing Ukraine to the West and face at home. For Putin to back down now would be unthinkable, said Daniel Treisman in CNN.com. The Kremlin's propaganda machine has convinced Russians that protecting Russian speakers in Crimea and eastern Ukraine is of crucial national importance, and proof of Putin's manhood. The West need not be powerless, said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. In response to this atrocity, the U.S. and the EU could send enough military aid to transform the Ukrainian army into a credible force, force Putin out of Ukraine, and treat Russia like the rogue state it has become. It won't happen. Europe's pacifism is so reflexive, and the continent is now so entwined economically with Russia, that appeasement has become the default position. This mass murder is an outrage that should not stand, but probably will. If the tragedy of Flight 17 proves anything, said Joshua Rovner in the Washington Post, it's that Putin isn't a master strategist after all. Conducting invasions by arming insurgent groups seemed clever, but it can backfire, because such groups are inherently uncontrollable and reckless. Putin's meddling in Ukraine has been disastrous for his country. The economy is tanking, and Russia is increasingly isolated. As the West considers its next move, it should be careful not to overestimate its adversary. Our controversy of the week, Perry versus Paul, the battle over GOP foreign policy. Will the GOP continue to be the party of hawkish foreign policy, or will it adapt to the public's strong pessimism about U.S. interventions abroad? That's the core issue in the new rhetorical fistfight that's broken out between Texas Governor Rick Perry and Senator Rand Paul, two likely contenders for the party's 2016 presidential nomination, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. Perry threw the first punch via an op-ed in which he accused Paul, a libertarian and outspoken critic of the Iraq War, of isolationism and of wanting to do next to nothing about the threat to U.S. posed by Islamist terrorists. Paul swung back with his own op-ed, denouncing Perry for ignoring the lessons of Iraq and wanting to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. This nasty personal exchange is partly the product of two rival candidates trying to raise their profiles and position themselves for the 2016 primaries, but it's also the opening skirmish in a much broader fight about the future of Republican foreign policy. Paul is doing the GOP a great service, said Nick Gillespie in thedailybeast.com. Out of a misplaced sense of loyalty, Republicans have spent a decade defending the go-it-alone crusaderism of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, in which the U.S. squandered thousands of lives and trillions of dollars trying, and failing, to remake Iraq and Afghanistan into secular, pro-Western democracies. A recent Pew poll finds that 52% of voters now believe the U.S. should mind its own business internationally, up from 42% only 8 years ago. If the GOP wants to win back the White House, it must follow Paul's lead, renounce the neocons, and embrace a less grandiose vision of American power. Perry's new hipster glasses may be fashionable, said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com. But his reflexive hawkishness is so last decade. The neocons' eagerness to send America's sons and daughters into civil wars in Iraq, Syria, and other broken nations is no longer what Americans, or even most Republicans, want from their would-be presidential candidates. Outside the media hype, there is no GOP schism, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. The Rand Paul wing of the party is just Rand Paul. Virtually the entire Republican leadership is united in supporting a muscular foreign policy, especially in the wake of President Obama's disastrous retrenchment from global conflicts. There may be a growing isolationist spirit within the GOP and the nation, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But with the rise of ISIS in Iraq and Vladimir Putin's rogue state Russia, the overseas threat is growing as well. It would take only one ugly event for Paul's trendy isolationism to suddenly look old-fashioned. Still, for the first time in a generation, the Republican Party is having a real internal debate on foreign policy, said Peter Sutterman in Reason.com. That uncertainty in itself provides the seed of a wiser new approach. Without ruling out overseas intervention, the GOP should embrace a foreign policy of caution and humility where U.S. interests are balanced against the inherent risk and unpredictability of war. It's a question of trust, said Justin Logan in TheFederalist.com. In recent years, Republicans have shown themselves to be careless stewards of precious American blood and treasure. To shed that reputation, they need to show they understand what was wrong with Bush and Cheney's disastrous foreign policy. Nothing shouldn't be an acceptable answer. Well, it was a good week for Richmond, Virginia, which was named the happiest metropolitan area in the U.S. in a survey of residents by the National Bureau of Economic Research. New York City was the unhappiest. It was a good week for distressed denim after a Japanese zoo auctioned off two pairs of jeans that had been mauled and gnawed by its lions. The denim was actually much tougher than we had thought, the zoo's director said. It turned out nicely destroyed. It was a good week for Agnes McKee, who celebrated her 105th birthday by throwing out the first pitch at a San Diego Padres game. I hope to see the Padres have a winning season during my lifetime, she said of the long-suffering team. It was a bad week for Catch-22, after a Glendora, California couple were threatened with a $500 fine by city officials if they didn't water their brown lawn. On the same day, state legislators authorized a fine of $500 for overwatering lawns. I felt like I was in an alternate universe, said Michael Corti. It was a bad week for Feeling the Music after a 97-year-old man was kicked out of a California nursing home because he ignored repeated orders to stop playing the ukulele. Management continually suppressed my talents, said Jim Farrell, who moved to another nursing home. It was a bad week for arachnophobes after a Seattle man used a can of spray paint and a lighter as a makeshift blowtorch to kill a spider and ended up burning down his house. I'm pretty sure the spider did not survive, said a fire department spokesman. And only in America, an Illinois double murder suspect has filed a 15-count complaint to a local judge about conditions in jail. He says his prison meals are boring and that the towels are too small. Adam Landerman, age 21, also complains that breakfast is served at the indecent hour of 6:15 a.m. and that the books in the library aren't up to date. We're not a hotel. We're a jail, responded Will County Sheriff's Deputy Chief Ken Coppas. Over on the briefing page, the militarization of America's police. Armed with battering rams and machine guns, paramilitary SWAT units are breaking into America's homes, Americans' homes. How heavily armed are the police? Many small-town police departments now boast the same weaponry once wielded by U.S. military units in Afghanistan, including tanks with 360-degree rotating turrets, battering rams, and automatic weapons. Those weapons are today deployed against Americans suspected of crimes in their own homes. Every day, special weapons and tactics, SWAT teams, connected to local police conduct 124 paramilitary-style raids in the U.S., according to a new report by the American Civil Liberties Union. One of them recently drew national attention when a SWAT team in Atlanta burst into a private home and threw a live flash grenade into a two-year-old's crib, severely injuring the toddler. Most raids by SWAT teams are conducted against suspected drug dealers, but they've also been deployed against a private poker game, a gay bar in Atlanta, a New Haven, Connecticut bar suspected of serving minors, and even people suspected of credit card fraud. Neighborhoods are not war zones, says the ACLU in its report, and our police officers should not be treating us like wartime enemies. Why do police have SWAT teams? The first SWAT team was created by the Los Angeles Police Department in 1967 and reserved for the most extreme circumstances, riots, hostage scenarios, and active shooter or sniper situations. But the war on drugs, coupled with the sense of danger promoted by the tragedies like Columbine Massacre in 1999 and the 9/11 terror attacks, encouraged police departments, even in small towns and rural areas, to create special units equipped and trained for worst-case scenarios. There's violence in schools, and there's violence in the streets, said Sheriff Michael Geyer of the Pulaski County in Indiana. If driving a military vehicle is going to protect officers, that's what I'm going to do. How do police get military equipment? In recent years, the Department of Homeland Security has provided $35 billion to local police throughout the country to help buy weapons for the war on terror. The rest can be traced to the Pentagon, which has offloaded $4.2 billion worth of surplus armored vehicles, rifles, and equipment to police departments as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have wound down. Cash-strapped police departments obtain these weapons for free. All they have to do is pay for the shipping. SWAT teams have obtained tens of thousands of machine guns, night vision goggles, silencers, armed helicopters, and armored vehicles. The Utah Highway Patrol, for example, owns a 55,000-pound mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, or MRAP, complete with a gunner's turret. I can drive this thing right through the middle of a gunfight, said Highway Patrol Lieutenant Alex Lepley. Are SWAT tactics an overreaction? In many cases, yes. Of the 124 SWAT raids conducted daily, only 7% meet the original LAPD criteria. About 62% of the raids are mounted to conduct drug searches, many of them based on tips from unreliable informants. Most are undertaken to investigate nonviolent offenses. In Orlando in 2010, for example, heavily armed SWAT teams raided 9 barbershops and arrested 34 people for barbering without a license. Adrenaline-fueled SWAT teams have often been accused of over-exuberance. In 2011, an Arizona paramilitary police unit riding in military vehicles, including a tank driven by special deputy and action movie star Steven Seagal, drove straight into the living room of an unarmed man suspected of staging cockfights. Such no-knock operations are now commonplace, often with tragic consequences. Why conduct no-knock raids? The premise is that people need to catch suspects unawares and prevent them from resisting or destroying evidence of their alleged crimes, say by flushing drugs down the toilet. So SWAT units routinely barge into houses unannounced, scream obscenity-laced commands to get down on the floor, and chuck flash grenades to disorient and subdue the occupants. In the general chaos and confusion, dozens of civilians have been killed. They include 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones, shot dead by police after one of their flash grenades set fire to her blanket. Other startled victims, assuming that their house is being invaded by armed intruders, are shot as they grab a gun to protect themselves. Innocent people are hurting, said criminal defense lawyer Muwali Davis. What reforms have been proposed? Changes could be made to the training of SWAT units, which the ACLU says teaches police to adopt a warrior mentality toward any citizen suspected of crimes. Other advocates have called for states to pass legislation forcing police to provide reports on every SWAT raid they conduct. But it might take a high-profile tragedy for such laws to be passed. Maryland is one of only two states with a law requiring its police to track their raids. That transparency bill only came in 2009 after the high-profile botched raid on the mayor of Berwyn Heights, during which his two dogs were shot dead, said Radley Balco, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. It was vigorously opposed by every police group in the state. Taking a look now at our columns, best columns. We'll start with one from the U.S., from Andrew Rudalavig at WashingtonPost.com. How Reagan reacted to KAL-007. He's no Ronald Reagan. It's what conservatives routinely say virtually every time they criticize President Obama's foreign policy, said Andrew Rudalavig. When Obama responded to last week's Malaysian Airlines tragedy with various statements of condemnation, Fox News and its ideological allies blasted Obama as a wimp for not leading, that is, taking some unspecified action to punish Russia. But what did Reagan do in 1983 when the Soviet Union shot down Korean Airlines Flight 007, killing 269 people, including a sitting U.S. congressman? He called the Soviet action monstrous and demanded an apology, but little action followed. Reagan ultimately decided not to end grain sales to the Soviets or suspend arms talks. Reagan's response did not get good reviews from conservatives. George Will called his administration pathetic, while the Manchester Union leader condemned Reagan's lack of retaliation as shocking and insane. Even at the height of the Cold War, however, Reagan believed in playing chess against enemies, not in knee-jerk escalations. We've got to protect against overreaction, he explained at the time. Vengeance isn't the name of the game. That was the real Reagan, not the one of conservative fantasy. This from Europe, an ugly surge in anti-Semitism. The conflict in Gaza is spilling into the streets of Europe, said Jill Riley and Alan Hall in the Daily Mail from the United Kingdom. Over the past 2 weeks, Israeli forces have pounded Gaza and Hamas has fired rockets into Israeli towns, anti-war demonstrations across the continent have shifted from anti-Israeli to anti-Jewish. In France, protesters torched cars in Jewish neighborhoods, destroyed several Jewish-owned stores, and even attacked synagogues. They are not screaming death to the Israelis on the streets of Paris, said Roger Kuckerman, the head of the Representative Council of the French Jewish Institutions. They are screaming death to the Jews. In Germany, demonstrators holding Israeli flags were kicked and beaten, while the pro-Palestinian camp chanted Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. One imam at a Berlin mosque reportedly told worshippers to murder Jews. We are currently experiencing in this country an explosion of evil and violent hatred of Jews, said Dieter Graumann, president of Germany's Central Council of Jews. In France, much of the anger comes from a perception that the government has sided with Israel, said Marion Gouraud in Le Monde. France has 600,000 Jews, the third largest population anywhere, after Israel and the U.S., and 6 million Muslims, the largest population in the EU. The government, therefore, ought to be especially careful in its pronouncements on Israel and Palestine. Yet President François Hollande, breaking with years of diplomatic precedent, announced his support of Israel's right to defend itself at the start of this conflict. After the first outbreak of anti-Jewish violence, the government even banned pro-Palestinian protests in Paris, which only encouraged the radicals to turn out. In any case, the troublemakers aren't the ethnic French, said Paul-Henri de Limbert in Le Figaro from France. Most of those who rioted this week, as in every other riot in recent memory, are children of immigrants from Arab and African countries. They hate Jews, yes, but not just Jews. The French are discovering that more and more of our compatriots are French citizens who hate France. It's thanks to them that we are getting a reputation as the most anti-Semitic country in the Western world. Germany can't let itself off so easily, said Ulf Porchardt in the Berliner Morgenpost from Germany. Anti-Semitism is certainly rife with the Muslim community here, but they weren't the only ones screaming, "Jews, cowardly pigs," at demonstrations last weekend. There were plenty of neo-Nazis and leftist activists as well. Such a repellent display is a national scandal. Jews are already immigrating from France in record numbers because they don't feel safe. Germany simply cannot let that happen here. Our history prohibits it. If Jews are hounded out of Germany once again, we will have lost our claim to democracy and our soul. And this comes from Mexico. "How we are just like Ukraine," from Victor Beltre at Excelsior. When a superpower arms criminals in another country, everyone blames the superpower for the resulting murders, right? Asked Victor Beltre. The international consensus is that Russian President Vladimir Putin is culpable, at least indirectly, in the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, because Russia presumably supplied Ukrainian rebels with the missile system that struck the plane. So why isn't the same logic being used against President Obama? American weapons have been pouring into Mexico for years. Some were supplied by the U.S. government as part of its Fast and Furious program to track how guns were traded among cartels. The only difference between Obama's guilt and Putin's is the number of deaths. The plane tragedy killed some 300 people, while American guns in Mexico have generated tens of thousands of deaths. Otherwise, the cases are parallel. In both countries, weapons arrived from the neighboring power in an effort to destabilize the area. And without those weapons, Ukrainian and Mexican thugs would not have been able to inflict mass casualties. Obama has invoked executive privilege in refusing to explain his government's decision to arm Mexican drug lords. I doubt he would accept a similar excuse from Putin. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The actor who put brains before brawn, James Garner, 1928 to 2014. James Garner was the original American antihero. A 6'3" Korean War veteran with a matinee idol's rugged good looks, the actor specialized in playing characters like TV's Brett Maverick and Jim Rockford, who eschewed guns and violence and won the day through a combination of scheming and self-effacing charm. Garner exhibited the same wily talents off-screen. In the 1980s, he sued Universal for cheating him out of profits from the Rockford Files and won an undisclosed sum, reportedly in the tens of millions of dollars. "I can't legally comment on that," Garner said of the figure. "But I can say that for a week or two afterward, my wife Lois had to keep telling me to wipe the grin off my face." Born in Norman, Oklahoma, James Scott Bumgarner left home at 14 and drifted from job to job, working as a waiter, a golf ball retriever, and a lifeguard. He was drafted for the Korean War in 1950 and was awarded the first of two Purple Hearts on his second day in action. Returning to the U.S. in 1952, Garner became an actor more or less by accident, said the Wall Street Journal. A friend got him a non-speaking role in a play starring Henry Fonda, and Garner soon signed a studio contract with Warner Brothers and was cast as the gambler rogue hero of the TV western Maverick. The upstart series' tongue-in-cheek formula worked, said the Los Angeles Times. And within months, the program was topping the ratings. Garner took a Machiavellian delight in studio politics, said the Daily Telegraph, and abruptly left Maverick in 1960 after becoming involved in a writer's strike. He sealed his reputation as an off-center iconoclast in 1974 with his role as a cranky private detective in the Rockford Files, but left that show after six seasons amid a dispute with Universal. In 1984, he gave what was arguably his best performance in Heart Sounds, a TV film documenting a doctor's death after a series of heart attacks. Garner remained a reluctant hero to the end, receiving the Screen Actors Guild's Lifetime Achievement in 2005, he quipped, "I'm not at all sure how I got here." The title of our Last Word article this week is, What Drives Jay Leno? The comedy legend not only collects rare classic cars, said David Underkoffler, he also takes them out for a spin. On a sunny day in Burbank Hills, Jay Leno's canary yellow McLaren supercar shatters the silence. Wedged into the cockpit of the 903 horsepower hybrid P1, Leno darts around a curve and leans into the throttle. With the midday roads free of traffic, the $1.2 million McLaren surges through the canyon with a controlled fury. "I just can't stop driving it," Leno says at a stop sign, before roaring off again. "It's just a perfect blend of science and technology, and you get the anthropomorphic sounds of the engine breathing." Back in Burbank, California, where the drive started, a nondescript hangar next to an airport houses Leno's enviable collection of 130 cars, 93 motorcycles, and a menagerie of engine spare parts and memorabilia. The world knows Leno from late-night TV and stand-up comedy, but within car circles, Leno and his collection eclipse even his contribution to the annals of television. The Tonight Show was a job. Cars are an obsession. Most blue-chip car collectors focus on a particular marquee or era and curate it like artwork. Jerry Seinfeld, for instance, sticks to Porsches. Local businessman Peter Mullen prefers French Art Deco cars and keeps his in a museum. Leno's friend and neighbor, Bruce Meyer, board vice president at LA's Peterson Automotive Museum, is into American hot rods. Leno takes a more organic approach. He just buys what he likes across a seemingly limitless spectrum of styles, eras, costs, countries of origin, and methods of propulsion. He's keen on cars with an intriguing backstory or those marking an engineering milestone. But mostly Leno just buys cars he wants to drive. He finds it silly to collect cars purely for show. "I never thought of it as a collection," said Leno, looking over the rows of neatly parked classics. "Probably in the mid-1980s, I just started to keep stuff." The simple strategy has since filled a warehouse with one of the world's most valuable and eclectic collections. There are old and new supercars, from such high-flying marquees as McLaren and Lamborghini. There's an American muscle car section, the vintage Bugatti section, the Duesenberg section. There are century-old electric cars and steam-powered cars of the same era. The British grouping houses the old-school Bentleys and Jaguars, and the odd Bristol and Lotus. Behind nearly every model is a huge hand-painted replica of an original advertisement for that car. Over the years, when NBC artists had downtime, Leno would pay them to recreate the ads in mural size. Look closely, and you'll notice Leno's likeness among the drivers. Leno was 14 when he bought his first vehicle for $350 in 1964. It was a 30-year-old Ford truck that, at first, sat idle in his parents' driveway in a middle-class suburb of Boston. Of course it didn't run. Why do you think my father let me buy it? Leno said with a chuckle. He learned how to get it running before he got his license. Leno then found work at a Rolls-Royce and Bentley dealership, where he first found inspiration to become an entertainer. His only chance, he figured, of ever owning a Bentley. His collection now includes a handful of vintage Bentleys from the 1920s and 30s. Yet for all Leno's talk about the intricacies and the histories of his cars, he never brings up the large sums of money involved. Jay doesn't buy for investment, said David Gooding, president and founder of Gooding & Company, a high-end auction house in Santa Monica, California. He is buying completely out of passion and love. Leno has picked up many cars long before the collecting world discovered them and started bidding up prices. These include the McLaren F1. In the late 1990s, these cars sold for about $1 million new. Gooding's company sold one last year for $8.5 million. Leno picked up many of his Duesenbergs before that market exploded. Models that were hundreds of thousands of dollars in the 1980s and 90s took off after 2000. They now regularly sell for millions of dollars. Leno's 1967 Lamborghini Miura P400, which Dean Martin bought new for his son Dino, was given to him nearly 30 years ago. At the time, the car's engine had seized after Dino hit a berm and cracked the car's oil pan. A friend of Leno's acquired the car, but he gave it to Leno after figuring out it would cost more to fix the Miura than it was worth. Leno had the engine rebuilt. Today, similar cars sell for at least $500,000. Whatever they are worth, Leno's cars are always ready to be driven. A key sits in every ignition. Every car has a charger cable running from the wall to the battery. Even the 1906 Stanley Steamer Cup Racer. That has the distinction of being the oldest car ever stopped for speeding on the 405, Leno said. It wasn't the speed that alerted the police. The car's boiler throws off steam and the occasional flame in normal operation. You're on fire, and it's a wood car, so you attract some attention, Leno said. The Cup Racer is parked with other steam-powered cars in a back room of a second hangar next door. The building holds a custom machine shop and a chassis dynamometer for testing horsepower. Though Leno is plenty handy with a wrench, a famously tight schedule means the entertainer leaves the tuning and maintenance to his staff of 4 full-time mechanics. They also build custom projects, such as the 1966 Oldsmobile Toronado that Leno had his mechanics convert from front to rear-wheel drive. It's hilariously fast, he said, popping the hood of the gold coupe to show off the twin-turbocharged 1,000-horsepower Corvette racing engine. You pull up next to Corvettes or Porsches on the freeway, they give you a nod, and you blow by them. Leno revels in the mechanical and historical nuances of each machine. The comedian often tries to explain a detail of one of his cars, only to have it go right over the heads of his fellow collectors, said Meyer, who has known Leno since the 1970s. That command of the details owes to Leno's hands-on approach to collecting. Because he loves to work on his cars himself, Jay has a very broad and in-depth knowledge about everything he owns, Gooding said. I've never met somebody so passionate and deeply knowledgeable about a wide array of cars. That includes his new McLaren P1. Leno was the first customer to take delivery of the ultra-rare $1.2 million sports car. He's put more than 1,000 miles on the odometer since getting the car in March. On Leno's recent jaunt through the Burbank Hills, the few drivers on the road gawked at his new toy, snapping pictures at stop signs and giving eager thumbs up. Although the McLaren could devour any racetrack, Leno usually limits his driving to public roads. He'll often cruise to an infamous curve on Malibu's Mulholland Highway, dubbed the Snake, or to Newcomb's Ranch, a bar and restaurant on the Angeles Crest Highway. Not everything in his collection is obscure or valuable. Many would be at home in any car enthusiast's garage. There's a 2008 Dodge Challenger, SRT8, a couple of Chevy Corvairs, a 1957 Buick Roadmaster convertible. Many of his cars, in fact, come from the garages of other car fans. The comedian's respect in the car community means he often gets the first phone call from an elderly owner or widow looking to send a car to a good home. I've been to car shows, and there will be a great car there, and the owner says, "When I get rid of it, I want Jay to have it," Meyer said. Unfortunately for Leno, the interest goes both ways. It's not uncommon for Leno or his wife, Mavis, to be handed a business card by someone interested in buying one of his cars after Leno dies. "It drives my wife bananas," Leno said. "People come up to her all the time." After finishing up a garage tour, Leno ambled back down the quiet corridor of the hangar and climbed into his 1955 Packard Caribbean for the commute home. Painted off-white with a bold red stripe on both sides that matches the red interior, the car is parked in front of an ad billing it as America's most glamorous sports car. The V8 rumbles to life, and a moment later, Leno glides out into the daylight. They make quite a pair. Two American icons facing an open road ahead. This was reprinted with permission from the Los Angeles Times, copyright 2014. Let's see what we've got on the health and science page today. About homing in on extraterrestrial life. NASA scientists say they will find proof of life on other planets within 20 years with the help of a new space telescope, the Los Angeles Times reports. The James Webb Space Telescope, scheduled for launch in 2018, will be the first space telescope capable of detecting biosignatures, the chemical footprints of life-sustaining compounds, in the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. The $8.8 billion device will build on the discoveries of its predecessor, the Kepler Space Telescope, which have led to the realization that nearly every one of the hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy has at least one planet orbiting it. The Webb is equipped with a 21-foot mirror, the largest ever to be sent into space, and will orbit at an altitude of 930,000 miles, four times the distance between the Moon and Earth. The telescope will scan exoplanet atmospheres for signs of oxygen, carbon dioxide, and other gases produced by living organisms. "Just imagine the moment when we find potential signatures of life," said Matt Mountain, director of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. "Imagine the moment when the human race realizes that its long loneliness in time and space may be over." The science of baby talk. A young child's first words may seem spontaneous, but a new study has found that infants actually practice speaking in their minds months before they start talking. The study involved 57 children aged 7 months, 11 months, and a year old. Researchers played syllables in English, the baby's native language, and Spanish, while using scanners to monitor their brain activity. With both languages, 7-month-olds showed increased activity in the parts of the brain that control the facial movements that produce words. Older infants, however, showed more brain activity in response to foreign syllables, which indicates that because they were more familiar with their native tongue, they therefore required more effort to process and try to mimic the unfamiliar sounds. The baby brain is engaged in trying to talk back right from the start, Patricia Kuhl of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences tells LifeScience.com. Her advice to parents? Talk to your baby. Hearing us talk exercises the action areas of infant brains. A family of friends. If you consider your friends to be like family, you may be onto something. Researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and Yale University have found that friends have more DNA in common with one another than they do with strangers. In fact, the similarities in gene signatures equate to 1% of a person's total genetic makeup, which means friends are roughly as related as fourth cousins, relatives who share great-great-great-grandparents. The striking thing here is that friends are actually significantly more similar to one another than we were expecting. UC San Diego geneticist James Fowler tells NPR.org, the study drew on data from more than 1,900 people and found that friends were most genetically similar in areas affecting the sense of smell, which researchers say may serve to draw people with similar tastes to congregate in the same place. Friends do, however, tend to have different kinds of immune systems. But such divergences may have evolutionary advantages, since a person who is susceptible to a certain type of disease would lower his or her risk of catching it by associating with others who are fortified against it. The biggest implication is that evolution can't be studied as a Robinson Crusoe phenomenon, Fowler says. We don't evolve isolated. We evolved with our friends. Over on the Talking Points page, we'll start with Elizabeth Warren, the Obama of 2016. Paging Elizabeth Warren, this is your moment, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Though Hillary Clinton is widely considered to be the inevitable Democratic presidential nominee for 2016, momentum has been building behind Massachusetts populist senator. Warren's feisty diatribes against Wall Street have made her a left-wing hero, and like Barack Obama in 2008, Warren could deal Clinton a nasty shock if she decides to challenge her in the primaries. For anyone who might wonder what unique traits the Massachusetts senator would bring, said Scott Conroy in RealClearPolitics.com, her stemwinder of a speech at the Netroots Nation conference last week provided a vivid answer. Waving her finger in the air like a sword, Warren said the tax code and the economy had been engineered to favor the wealthy and the powerful. The game is rigged, shouted Warren. We can whimper about it, or we can fight back. I'm fighting back. The crowd's wild response, run, Liz, run. Warren 2016 is a fantasy, said Bill Scheer in Politico.com. The former Harvard law professor has given flat denials that she's running and is limiting her focus in the Senate to her pet domestic issues, with no telltale attempt to establish credibility on international affairs. While it's true that Democrats may have given their hearts to Warren, said Katie Gluck, also in Politico.com, their heads ultimately remain with Clinton because they're confident she can beat any Republican. In the latest RealClearPolitics.com polling figures for the Democratic nomination, Clinton sits at 65%, almost 60 points higher than Warren. True, Clinton's alliance with liberals is a marriage of necessity, not passion, but each side knows they need it to work. That's a shame, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. A Warren presidential bid would be good for all Americans. Republicans could hope Warren would pull Clinton to the left, exposing her as a rich liberal posing as a working-class hero. For Democrats, Warren would make Clinton distance herself from Wall Street allies and take a stronger stand on income inequality. Facing a real challenge, Clinton would also be forced to explain what she believes and why she's running. Surely that would make 2015 and 2016 more fun and politically informative than a campaign based on the premise, it's my turn. Pit bulls. the most hated dog in America. Wantonly bred, frequently abused, and promiscuously abandoned, the pit bull is the most misunderstood dog in America, said Tom Junod in Esquire. As many as 3,000 pit bulls are euthanized in U.S. shelters every day. But despite being widely reviled and passionately defended, pit bull is not even a breed. It's a classification based on physical characteristics suggesting a genetic link to the American pit bull terrier, the Staffordshire Bull Terrier, and similar dogs. Yet there is no other dog that plays a more central role in the national narrative, usually in the wake of a frightening attack on a child or other innocent bystander. I've owned 2 pit bulls and can tell you they are not all alike. It's simply not fair to blame all pit bulls for attacks that result from poor training or mistreatment by humans. That's just one more example of a pit bull owner living in denial, said Heather Wilhelm in RealClearPolitics.com. Despite the overwhelming statistical evidence that pit bulls are far and away the most dangerous dog in America, enthusiasts insist their pets are sweet, loving, and funny and wouldn't hurt a flea. But the numbers don't lie, said Charlotte Alter in Time. Pit bulls make up only 6% of the dog population, but they're responsible for 68% of dog attacks and 52% of dog-related deaths since 1982. Herding dogs have been bred to herd, pointing dogs to point. Pit dogs were bred to go into a pit and fight with incredible aggression and biting power. When they attack, they maul people and other dogs and even kill them. As a plastic surgeon at a children's hospital emergency room, said David Billmeyer in the Cincinnati Inquirer, I can tell you that the problems associated with dog bites are indeed breed specific. I've rebuilt the noses, lips, eyelids, jaws, and cheeks of numerous children disfigured in pit bull attacks. I watched a child bleed to death after a pit bull tore his throat out. The risk posed by pit bulls is equivalent to placing a loaded handgun with the safety off on the coffee table. There are plenty of breeds capable of peacefully coexisting with human society. How many mauled children do we have to see before we realize the folly of allowing these dogs to exist? Kansas, the death of supply-side economics. For the past 2 years, the people of Kansas have been the subjects of a remarkable experiment, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. Its aim? To test the hotly debated question of whether tax cuts can spur enough economic activity to pay for themselves. In 2012, Republican Governor Sam Brownback cut individual state tax rates a whopping 25% and eliminated various small business taxes. He claimed that this pro-growth policy, tax policy, which he expanded with more cuts last year, would be like a shot of adrenaline into the heart of the Kansas economy and actually boost tax revenue. Oops. Kansas's tax revenue has plunged $700 million in a year, forcing big cuts to education funding. Revenue losses may total $5 billion in 2019. Meanwhile, Kansas's job and income growth lag behind the nation's, and polls show Brownback could lose the next election to a Democrat. In a state as conservative as Kansas, you have to screw up pretty badly to be in that position. Despite all the liberal gloating, it is probably too early to tell if the Kansas experiment was a failure, said David Brunori in Forbes.com. It takes time for people to decide whether it's worth uprooting their families or their businesses and move to a state with lower taxes. Over time, low tax rates do draw businesses and stimulate tax state economies, said Stephen Moore in the Kansas City Star. Over the past 2 decades, the 9 states without an income tax have had double the population growth and more than double the income growth of states with very high income taxes. Are the liberals really going to say this is all a coincidence? Supply-side economics was proven to be bogus long ago, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. When Bill Clinton raised taxes in the 1990s, conservatives predicted a recession, only to see years of unprecedented prosperity. The tax cut myth is still alive only because it's sustained by the money and influence of billionaire businessmen and the American Legislative Exchange Council, a secretive group funded by corporation which insists that tax cuts are the key to prosperity for all. It didn't work when George W. Bush tried it, nor is it working in Kansas. But faith in tax cut magic isn't about evidence. It's about giving rich people and corporations what they want. And just a few notes for you. Hillary Clinton has made $12 million in speaking fees since leaving the State Department in February 2013, an average of $750,000 a month. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, fewer than 1 million Afghan children were enrolled in elementary schools, and just 5,000 of them were girls. Today, more than 8 million Afghan kids go to an elementary school, including more than 3 million girls. In 1975, the average American vacation lasted more than a week, according to the U.S. Travel Association. By 1985, it had shrunk to 5.4 days, and by 2010, to 3.8 days. The poll watch, in the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians, 51% of Americans said they sympathize more with Israel and 14% with the Palestinians. 15% sympathize with neither side and 3% with both. And we'll wind up with a quote here. This comes from poet Samuel Ullman. Years may wrinkle the skin, but to give up enthusiasm wrinkles the soul. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerb for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.